You can join me now in Matthew chapter 6. And I'm curious to know how many of you have heard the phrase Ponzi scheme before. Raise your hands if you're familiar with those words, Ponzi scheme. Chances are we've all heard that phrase at some point or another. But what is that exactly? What is a Ponzi scheme? Well, technically speaking, a Ponzi scheme is a kind of investing scam in which investors are tricked and they are conned, they are bamboozled into investing their money into fake enterprises with the promise of receiving high and immediate returns on their investment. They, of course, do receive what's promised to them, at least in the beginning, for a short while. But then it all leads to significant losses in the long term for the investor, and that because of what the money was invested in, or not invested in, to be more precise. You see, what happens in a Ponzi scheme is an investor gives his money to a supposed broker, who happily takes the money, by the way, and keeps a large portion of it for themselves, returning a smaller portion of it back to the investor, claiming and lying through their teeth that what that return is actually the interest and earnings on their investment. Of course, this motivates the investor and all of his friends that he's told about this deal to give even more to the investment, which they do. And again, the broker keeps the majority of that portion and gives back a small percentage of it, claiming that that is their earnings. And on the cycle goes, until it becomes impossible to keep giving fake returns to everybody, and the whole charade falls apart. And everybody ends up broke. Everybody ends up broke, including the broker, who actually ends up more than just broke. He ends up in prison. Just Google sometime, Charles Ponzi, and you'll learn all about the swindler from the 1920s. Who we coined the phrase after, and who died. He died with barely a coin to his name, despite his short-lived life of luxury. It's really a sad story. What stands out to me about our passage this morning in Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 19, is some really wise investing advice on the part of Jesus to his disciples, not to waste their lives, and to not make fools out of themselves by buying into the Ponzi scheme-like opportunities that the world offers, since all that the world offers is temporary anyway, but rather to spend our lives and to truly invest our resources in something infinitely more rewarding and infinitely longer lasting. We're going to be looking at both sides of the claim this morning. We're going to be looking at what Jesus argues are, in and of themselves, ultimately bad long-term investments for the Christian to get caught up in. And in contrast to that, we're going to see what he says are, in actuality, the truly good investments or interests we should want to be pursuing. So Jesus starts off by exposing the bad investment the world offers to us. Notice in verse 19 he says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal." If there ever was a Ponzi scheme in the works, if there ever was a widespread conspiracy affecting the real balance of our worth as individuals, Jesus says it's the entire monetary system of wealth and materialism itself. He raises issue with the entire category of what he simply summarizes here as treasures on earth. He bundles it all together. And if we wanted to try and unpack that, though, what could we say that that includes? What are treasures on earth, to try and define it? I would say treasures on earth would have to include any such thing we regard to have material value. And I suppose wrapped up even in that thought of having material value could include things that would have sentimental value. I don't think we have to have an actual appraiser come and say, okay, this item has such and such a value. If it's valuable to us, it's valuable to us. I think Jesus is talking about anything of perceived value, from the crown jewels that are up in the Tower of London to Aunt Matilda's Beanie Baby collection that she has stuffed under her deathbed. You know, and anything in between of that. Anything of perceived value. Treasures on earth are simply those tangible things on earth we value. Gold, silver, cash, real estate, jewelry, shoes and clothes, antique furniture, new furniture, collector's items, cars, trucks, tools, gadgets, family heirlooms, books, toys, pets, vacation spots, guns, fishing gear, hunting gear, camping gear. We could just list a huge list. Whatever things that have a perceived value to you could be included in the category treasures on earth. And what Jesus is saying is, Jesus is saying all of them in the long term, and I'm trying to choose my words carefully here, evaluate this statement, all of them in the long term, in and of themselves, and by their very natures are bad investments. Earthly treasures, in the long term, in and of themselves, and by their very nature are bad investments. Why? Why are treasures on earth bad investments? Well, he says it's because all earthly treasures can really offer us are relatively short-term gains and high-risk losses. By the way, that's the definition of a bad investment. Short-term gain, high risk of loss. In the end, all earthly treasures can really deliver on are momentary benefits. The problem with earthly treasures is they don't last forever. He talks about the reality of moths and rust that can and eventually will destroy the things we value. And if you stop to think about it, it can be really unsettling. It can be a little bit depressing to think about how little bugs, little processes called oxidation can turn any of our valuables to dust. I don't own a whole lot of clothes. Ethan and Jonathan could probably tell you that they would notice it. Well, maybe they wouldn't say this. Guys don't care about this kind of thing. But if they were observant, they might be able to tell you that I pretty much rotate through the same set of shirts and pants at the office because I just don't have a huge wardrobe. I especially don't have a whole lot of suit jackets. In fact, for the longest time, for a number of years, I just had one black suit jacket in my closet, which I'd wear to, you know, the important occasions, to weddings and to funerals and things like that. It was at the last Christmas concert we had at the Bible Church of Little Rock. You remember we participated in that. I had a little part in the service. You may remember I wasn't wearing my black suit jacket that day. And the reason is because we get to the day of the Christmas concert, and I go and get my black suit jacket from the closet, and it has a giant hole right in the shoulder. What happened? Moths happened. And I'll be honest with you, I was really discouraged about that. Because what I had to do is I had to wear my gray jacket. So I had a black jacket and a gray jacket, that's all I had. I had to wear my gray jacket, and I wasn't so much bummed because it was gray, I was bummed because I didn't have the black. I thought it fit pretty well, and now I don't have it anymore. So I was really bummed about that. And as I'm preparing this sermon, in fact, right here, I go to tie my shoes. My shoelace breaks. I'm like, hey, that's a perfect sermon illustration. But really, it wouldn't matter what week I preach a sermon. I could give you an example almost any week of something that is breaking around my house. I could tell you stories about how I've sometimes left tools out in the yard working on a project. And I get, you know, pulled away to work on something else. I forget about the tool. A rainstorm comes. Then I come out and oh yeah, there's my tool, and it's got rust spots all over it. And it's just, it's frustrating. It's unsettling, and really the rust thing was my fault, but it's just the nature of the material world. Sometimes I feel like it's a losing battle because it is a losing battle. If it's not my clothes, it's my tools. If it's not my tools, it's the tile on my floor. If it's not the tile, it's my appliances. You know what I'm talking about. There's always something that's wearing out. There's always something that is breaking. I think James, in James chapter 5, verse 1, kind of hits the nail on the head when he says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl." That's how I feel often. "Weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are rotting. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire." By the way, that passage raises another interesting point to all of this, and that is that even if the lifetime warranty on some of your stuff outlasts you, when your body finally wears out and you die, you're not going to be taking any of that stuff with you. I read a story about how when the late John D. Rockefeller passed away, and you may be familiar with that name and the great wealth that man had accumulated. But as at his funeral, another man walks up to the family accountant, the Rockefeller's family accountant, and he asks, "So, how much did Mr. Rockefeller leave behind?" And the accountant simply said, "All of it." All of it. That's so true. Reminds me of what Billy Graham once famously said. He said, "In all my life, I have never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul." That's an interesting way to think about it, but that is so true. We bring nothing into the world, and we will take nothing out of it. In addition to moths and rust, Jesus talks about the danger of theft. He talks about thieves who can break in and steal. In other words, if bugs don't end up eating all of our stuff, and if they don't erode away by the sands of time, it's entirely possible that a thief will break in and just walk off with your stuff. Back in June, my family took a little bit of a vacation. We went to Atlanta, and I don't know how it happened, but somebody, while we were on that trip, got a hold of my credit card information. And I hear that they've got these scanners these days where they can just walk past you and swipe your wallet area or something like that, and they get the credit card information. I don't know how it works. But somebody gets my credit card information. They start making these fraudulent charges, and sure enough, when I get back, I check the bank statement, and there are transactions for a Lyft taxi service. Lyft. Have you heard of Lyft? In California, somebody's getting taxi rides on my expense. I see expenses showing up for retail clothing store purchases in New Jersey and Como, Italy. So I canceled that card and, you know, did the whole identity theft process there. But it's frustrating, right? The point is that earthly treasures are short-term, high-risk kinds of investments. Not even digital forms of ownership are safe. People could just hack in and steal that away. And so, as we think about all of this, what is the obvious takeaway? What is the wisest application of these facts? Is it not this? Is it not to not invest solely, primarily, and ultimately in earthly treasures? Just don't put your investment in those things. Or as Jesus says in verse 19, don't lay them up. Don't lay them up. Of course, that's another one of those statements that requires some explanation. I don't think what Jesus means when he says don't lay up earthly treasures is to not make use or to not own anything that is material. He's not calling his disciples to lives of asceticism here. Rather, the idea of laying up treasures on earth has more to do, I think, with not obsessively piling up as hoarders and misers and pack rats the things we try to pile up and to hold in reserve for no other purpose than to know that we have them, even if we don't necessarily need them. Because when we do that, we waste them. We waste them. In more than one parable, Jesus condemns a person for their short-sighted approach to stewardship, in which they assume that the wisest financial course is to lay up or to lay away what they have received in the same monetary form that they received it. Think through some of these with me. In the parable of the talents, you remember that one? In the parable of the talents, the man is rebuked for taking what his master gave him and doing what? Burying it in a field. In the parable of the minas, the man is rebuked for taking his portion, and you remember what he did with it? He puts it in a handkerchief. In the parable of the rich fool, the rebuke comes to a wealthy farmer who has so much harvest, evidently more than he could possibly use. So what does he do? He tears down his old barn, and he builds a new barn in order to store it all. And his attitude in that decision is described for us in Luke 12, verse 19. And here's where the rebuke centers. It's not just the decision, it's the attitude that would prompt him to make that decision. The attitude is, after he builds that second barn, he assures himself, saying, "Soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years now. Relax, eat, drink, be merry." But then what does God say in reply to that? God says, "You fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasures for himself and is not rich toward God." If there is one truth that Jesus is trying to impress on his disciples as he reiterates the same point so often in his parables, it is this: there is a better way to invest. There is a better way to invest. There is a kind of wealth and there is a kind of richness that your Charles Schwab advisor simply cannot calculate. So Jesus starts explaining what that better investment is in verse 20. "But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal." Whereas the Ponzi scheme of laying up treasures on earth can only promise us short-term gains and high-risk losses. Alternatively, Jesus says that having treasures in heaven offer a far better return. And that has got to be a major understatement. On the scale of eternity, there is no comparison. One will last like as a vapor and be gone in the blink of an eye. The other has no end. For the other, there is no risk of theft. Heaven is often described as being constructed with the most permanent of foundations and the most precious of materials. It's even said in Revelation, and I read the verse earlier this morning, that heaven will possess an impenetrable wall. Did you notice that? An impenetrable wall so that, quote, "nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." So heaven, we are told, is permanent, it is precious, and it is safe. To be clear, when we are talking about treasures in heaven, we are not merely talking about those things that resemble heavenly versions of material treasures. The Bible does talk about streets of gold. All right, it does talk about foundations of precious stones such as jasper and sapphire and agate and emerald and onyx and all the rest. It does talk about gates of pearl. The Bible does talk about a crystal sea and many mansions or rooms that are ready to be filled. It talks about a crown of life and a river of life and a tree of life, and I have no doubt that Jesus is referring to all of those things when he talks about treasures in heaven. But the real treasure in view and from which all of those other treasures receive their value is God. Revelation 21 verse 10 describes the new heaven and the new earth as, quote, coming down from God, having the glory of God, and reflecting His radiance. Revelation 22 verse 1 describes the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the city. In other words, God is the source of the treasure that is heaven. Or to say it another way, God is the treasure that is heaven. Heaven is not heaven because of the streets of gold. Heaven is not heaven even because there may be loved ones there. On Judgment Day, we may find that some of our loved ones aren't there. But heaven is heaven for no other reason than because God is there. And the psalmist reflects on these very points when he writes in Psalm 73, verse 25, Whom have I in heaven but you? Whom have I in heaven but you? Sure, there may be loved ones in heaven, but that is not on the forefront of the psalmist's mind. Whom have I in heaven but God? That is who makes heaven heaven. He goes on and says, and there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail. We could probably add to that list, my wardrobe and my tools may fail. But God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. So as we think about all of those facts, what is the obvious takeaway? What is the wisest application of these facts? Is it not this? To invest then as much as we can in heaven's treasure, or as Jesus tells his disciples in verse 20, to lay them up. To lay them up. And I'm hoping that all of that makes sense to us. We can connect the dots pretty easily to see how earthly treasures, because of their temporary nature, are not the wisest of investments in the long term, and how heaven would be the greatest investment because of its eternality. But how do we do it? How do we do that exactly? How do we invest in treasures in heaven? It's not like we can go and we can log into our bank account and make an electronic transfer. And yet, transferring funds is not a bad way of thinking about how this works. Granted, there's not going to be a routing number that you can plug in where you can wire your money to heaven. Transferring money isn't even the point. None of us are going to need money in heaven. But what Jesus is saying is that our money and in reality, all of our resources or any of our earthly treasures can be exchanged. They can be exchanged for a heaven-oriented return so long as they are used while we have them for heaven-oriented purposes. The rebuke that is directed to the poor steward is never for having means on earth. That the rich man is never rebuked for being rich, but it's always for not using those riches and not using those means for eternal ends. Jesus later describes the kingdom of heaven as like a treasure in a field, which a man finds and covers up, and in his joy he goes and he sells. We could say he transfers all that he has and he buys the field. The treasure is not the field, but the treasure is in the field, so he buys the field. What does that look like practically? I think what it looks like is us needing to be perceptive enough to know what overgrown fields possess the treasure. We have to be able to see heaven. We have to be able to see God in those opportunities to invest, in those opportunities to feed the hungry, or to house the traveler, or to clothe the naked, or to visit the imprisoned and the sick. Jesus says, truly I say to you, as you did it to the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. The overgrown field may not look like something worth investing in. Volunteering to do child care, for yard work or church cleaning, or go down the list of all of the opportunities that you have to serve and to give. And they might not seem on the surface to be something that you really want to invest your time and energy in, but I tell you that each possess a share for a holding in heaven, and you would be wise to lay up as much of it as you can. How do we know if that's what we're doing? How do we know if we are investing in treasures in heaven? In verse 21, we're given a good ruler to measure ourselves against. He says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Since our treasure in heaven isn't calculated by dollars and cents, and it's not even calculated by the tax records that your church treasurer produces for you at the end of the year, accounting for how many contributions you made, we do not want to buy into the lie of, say, John Tetzel, who went around in the late 1400s leading many a poor Christians in Germany astray by saying that the amount you put into the offering box has a direct proportionate payoff in heaven, and that God is keeping a ledger somehow, a ledger of how much you give. It is not about how much you give, but about how much you are treasuring. That often has a bearing on how much we give, but giving is not the ruler. The heart is the ruler. What we treasure in our hearts is what we treasure. Now, granted, if we try to test our hearts on this scale, that can be somewhat of a subjective test, because the heart itself is deceptive. So we may end up wanting to flatter ourselves, which is why I appreciate how Jesus illustrates this with a very practical way of thinking about what our hearts treasure, and that is by tracking our eyes. Look in verse 22. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? In other words, Jesus is saying that the eye is the window to the soul. You want to have a glimpse into what your heart loves? Take some time to notice what your eyes tend to gravitate towards. That's a good evaluation. What does your heart love? Well, what are your eyes glued to? What captures your attention? What pleases your eye? And you may have an answer to your question. If your vision is healthy and you have good sight, you're going to see beautiful and radiant things, which reflects on your soul. But if your vision is impaired and you have poor sight, all you're going to see are dark and dim things, and that's all your heart will ever know to love. Finally, Jesus says in verse 24, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. In the same way that the treasure of our hearts can be exposed by what our eyes and our attention most often dwells on, it can also be exposed by the level of devotion and real service that we apply toward something. Again, you want to know what your heart loves. Do you want to know where your true loyalties lie? Well, just evaluate what interests, or we could say whose interests, are you working hardest for? Who is the real master over your life? When the Israelites, when they were in captivity in Egypt, were doing all of their labors, it was clear who the boss was. It was clear to everybody that Pharaoh was in charge. Exodus chapter 1, verse 11, the text says, therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. The whole nation, the whole generation was basically born into that arrangement, whether they liked it or not, and we have clue that they didn't like it because they were crying out to God, remember. They were crying out to God for him to hear them and rescue them from their burdens. Everybody was serving the same agenda, but thank God the Lord heard their cries and He called them out of their bondage. He set them free to serve not Pharaoh and not to continue contributing to the monuments and the stockpiles of Egypt, but to serve God and to build up a new nation. What Jesus is doing, as we've discussed throughout the Sermon on the Mount, is He is calling His disciples to build a new kingdom, to serve a new master, to build a kingdom that is greater than any other kingdom of the world, and to serve a master who is greater than any other ruler of this world, whether that ruler be a man or that ruler be the almighty dollar. If we are going to be faithful in fulfilling that calling, our hearts and our eyes and our hands and even our pocketbooks must all be invested in the same treasure, and that is God. It is Christ. And the beauty of the cross is that through the power of Jesus' blood and through the power of a transformed life, what occurs is we too may be rescued from our materialistic bondage to serve God and to serve His interests. And my prayer is that that is what He would accomplish in all of us. Let's pray.